cinéma.
Welcome to the fifth episode of The Definitives, a limited-time music podcast detailing the makings and legacies of some of the greatest rock albums ever made. I'm your host, Blake Peterson, and today we'll be talking about White Blood Cells, the third studio album by the garage rock two-piece, The White Stripes. One of my favorite albums, at least conceptually, is Grace Jones's Slave to the Rhythm. It was released in 1985, right around the time she had infiltrated the mainstream both through her acting and her cult-level popular musical output. Though her previous two LPs, 1981's Nightclubbing and 1982's Living My Life, were straightforward and economic, though innovative and idiosyncratic, Slave to the Rhythm was operatic and really weird. It lasts 43 minutes, but is only 8 songs long. It is, typical of Jones, bold and non-conforming, but it is also steeped in a style that manages to make it kind of alien. It's obviously a highly stylized version of whatever the truth may be. It is packaged as if it were personal. The album is called a quote-unquote biography in the liner notes, but none of the songs were written by Jones. Every track was penned by Trevor Horn, Bruce Woolley, Stephen Lipson, and Simon Darlow. Nonetheless, Slave to the Rhythm aims to be a musicalization of the life of Grace Jones with personal aplomb. Specifically, it covers how she entered the fashion world in her 20s, and how she went on to further her career through musical projects and acting work. Her controversial yet career-defining relationship with the artist and photographer Jean-Paul Goude is memorably featured. The actor Ian McShane literally reads passages from the former's autobiography, Jungle Fever, that sometimes overtake entire songs. Slave to the Rhythm is technically a Grace Jones album, but unlike her previous works, her relationship to it is strangely disconnected. It almost seems to be an album about Grace Jones that she happens to be involved with. She arguably feels like a cipher for the artistic inclinations of the people producing the album. It's something akin to a photographic spread or a documentary. It's both personal and outside. But Slave to the Rhythm is committed to elongating a very specific sound, and I think it pulls it off tremendously. Like Serge Gainsbourg's Histoire de Melanie Nelson or The Who's Tommy, it is committed to three-dimensionalizing its central concept, unconcerned with whether we take to its outer attributes or not. The album's centerpiece is its fifth track and lead single, Slave to the Rhythm. Arguably, everything on the album builds off that, whether the result is an inflated version or a very deconstructed edition. Throughout the LP, there are sprinkled in staged interviews between Jones and an unknown journalist. I find it to be more about the ambitions of its lead producer, Trevor Horn, than it is necessarily about Jones revealing herself. There are few albums I can think of that feel so self-contained and dependent on a concept and come out as thrilling as Slave to the Rhythm. It is even rarer for a musical act to be as dependent on and committed to a concept in the way Slave to the Rhythm is. I consider The White Stripes to be one of those anomalous acts. The band is made up of only two people, and both of them are recognizable for their milk-white skin and jet-black hair. They only dress in three colors, black, white, and red. They, in spite of being a twosome, often reference the number three. Their instruments and stage design often matched. Each song aesthetically merges. The drums are uncommonly sparse, whereas the guitar and vocal work are unpredictable and sometimes intense. Centrally, the music is bluesy and sometimes punk-inspired, but is made unique by the influence of the band's frontman, Jack White. For the entirety of the White Stripes' nearly 15-year-long career, they were easily identifiable both for their look and sound. The attentiveness toward a concept, as displayed by Slave to the Rhythm, parallels what the White Stripes impressively did for so many years: have a core idea of how they wanted to be perceived, and use that as a creative driving force. Their sound was intrinsically in tune with their primary objective, yet it was exploratory too. There are not many musical acts who remain so singular and conceptually dependent. The quote-unquote gimmick of the White Stripes was not something they only ephemerally stuck to. They stuck with it and refined it when need be. The duo was among the most acclaimed and commercially successful quote-unquote indie rock dyads of the aughts, and continues to be the most famous project Jack White has ever been part of. Even those who are unfamiliar with the band's musical output on the whole likely at least know the riff that defines their 2003 single Seven Nation Army, which has long been a popular chant at sports games. It is the band's work in the earlier part of the 2000s, though, that has garnered them the most acclaim. Their 2003 album, Elephant, featured the aforementioned single and a host of other now semi-classic tracks. It was also a favorite at the Grammys and on Best of the Year lists. But it is the band's breakthrough, 2001's White Blood Cells, that today is regarded as the two pieces' finest work. While it received considerable positive attention upon its release, it is retrospectively regarded as one of the great LPs of the noughties, and in some cases, all time. It's not my personal favorite album by the band. I much prefer the experimental Get Behind Me Satan from 2005, but White Blood Cells is indubitably their most coherent and immeasurably listenable. It is no surprise that it made for their breakthrough, or that it has grown in stature so much. It is essential, the record that didn't hint at the domination to come, but rather demand the domination that would come. In the fifth episode of The Definitives, I'm going to talk about the pre-stages, making, and aftermath of White Blood Cells, the White Stripes' influential, much-adored breakthrough LP. The White Stripes formed in 1997 in Detroit, Michigan. At the time of the band's inception, its members, singer and guitarist Jack White and drummer Meg White, had known each other for a few years. Both born and raised in Michigan, they first met while Jack was in high school. Meg bartended at the Memphis Smoke, a restaurant where Jack often read his poetry during open mic nights. A friendship between the two blossomed quickly, and by 1996, Jack and Meg were married. Jack, who was born John Gillis, subversively took his new wife's last name, which is something that has obviously remained. In the years previously, Jack found himself stuck between two professions. He was a passionate musician and was tied to Detroit's garage rock scene, playing in bands like Goober and the Peas, The Go, The Henchmen, and Two Star Tabernacle. For a time, he was part of The Upholsterers, a two-piece in which he played with Brian Muldoon, an upholsterer. Here's a clip from one of their songs, Pain, Give Me Sympathy, which was released in 2000. Pain, give me sympathy. Pain, give me. Yeah. Pain, give me sympathy. Oh, pain, give me. Yeah. Deep down in my heart, there's a feeling like a burning explosion. And I run with emotion. But he was also connected to the upholstery business. In his teenage years, he was the apprentice of the previously mentioned Muldoon, and at 21, Jack started his own small company, Third Man Upholstery. Famously, that didn't work out. While there was never necessarily a lacking of customers, Jack was so unprofessional that it was impossible to be profitable. He wrote bills in crayon. He wrote poems on the inside of reupholstered furniture. He wasn't very financially savvy. Meg, in contrast, was never musically inclined. Shy and a self-described quote-unquote good girl, she was a kid who spent most of her time record shopping and going to the movies. While in college, and then in catering school, she considered becoming a chef. She ultimately ended up becoming a bartender. This, of course, is what led her to meet Jack. Jack and Meg's decision to form a band was never exactly planned. As mentioned earlier, they were married in 1996 and were living in Jack's childhood home. His parents had retired and had arranged that their son and his new wife would be able to live there. Jack kept a drum kit upstairs and would often play. But one evening, Bastille Day 1997 to be exact, Meg thought it would be fun to try the instrument out for herself. Jack joined in, on guitar. He later said, quote, "We were just messing around, kind of as a joke, but it ended up being perfect. She played like such a child. It was something fresh," unquote. Their initial jam resulted in the song Screwdriver, which would later be featured on their self-titled debut album from 1999. Here's an excerpt. The Stripes' first public appearance came on August 15th. They were opening for the Henchmen, a band with whom Jack often played, at Detroit's Gold Dollar Bar. The venue was famously situated in a bad part of town. Jason Stolzheimer of the Von Bondies once said that bands who played there regularly got their car windows smashed and their stuff stolen. Their performance was well received, and soon the White Stripes started regularly doing shows in the area. It was around then that the red, black, and white thing stuck. It was also agreed that Jack and Meg would pretend they were brother and sister in order to avoid having people speculate on the state of their marriage. In October, the Stripes were approached by David Buick, who then owned Italy Records, a local independent garage rock-focused label. He'd only put out two records thus far, and he wanted the Stripes to be the third. Buick later said, quote, "I asked Jack about it. He said he didn't have any money and walked away. And then I had to explain to him that I'd pay for it. He was really naive about the whole process," unquote. After some time, Jack changed his mind. In 1998, Buick released the first Stripes single, Let's Shake Hands. This was followed by Lafayette Blues. Here's part of the former. The singles caught the attention of the local music press. They were particularly acclaimed in zines, to the point that Pavement, the successful Stephen Malkmus-fronted indie band, asked the Stripes to support them on an upcoming tour. Jack and Meg agreed and played a few shows with them on the East Coast. Around that time, Buick said that he received myriad calls, some of them international, trying to get in contact with the Stripes. Later, the band was invited to tour with Sleater Kinney, despite the latter group never meeting them in person. The Stripes' debut album, The White Stripes, was made for little money and released in June 1999 for sympathy for the record industry. It didn't cause too much of a stir commercially, but did receive some good notices. Their follow-up, 2000 Stay Still, expanded on that. Recorded on an 8-track analog in Jack's living room, it reached number 38 on the U.S. independent album charts by 2002 and got excellent reviews from Pitchfork, New Musical Express, and others. In a matter of a few years, the Stripes were en route to rock ubiquity. Even Jack and Meg's divorce in March of 2000 didn't put a halt to their impetus. Their next musical effort, White Blood Cells, would live up to the hype and take them to new heights. For the recording of White Blood Cells, Jack and Meg imposed new limitations. There would be no outside musicians, no cover songs, and no self-indulgent guitar solos. Instead of making their sound bigger, they were going to dissect what they had already been doing well and improve on it. They would avoid the blues-first approach and try out something even more personal. Said White later on, quote, "We completely avoided the blues, on purpose. The thing was, what can we do if we completely ignore what we love the most? We figured out the nose, and everything else was fine. we were forcing ourselves so harshly to create something out of nothing, unquote. This newfound semi-self-punishment would become a trademark for Jack. As he's revealed in several interviews, he likes to challenge himself. He'll purposefully play guitar at live shows prone to going out of tune. While playing drums with one of his supergroups, the Dead Weather, he sets up the drums in such a way that makes playing the instrument feel sort of natural. Going into the recording process, Jack said that he and Meg tried to keep rehearsals as loose as possible. They wanted to have something of an idea of what they'd be doing during production, but they didn't want to have ideas so set in stone that there wouldn't be room to improvise and change things at the last minute. For White Blood Cells, Jack and Meg chose to record at the Memphis-based Easley McCain Studio, which was a 24-track recording facility known for being used by such acts as Sonic Youth, Jeff Buckley, Pavement, Townes Van Sant, and others. The band had never visited the place, but because its reputation was so good, it was decided that the risk was worth it. Plus, Memphis, fondly referred to as the home of the blues, was a creatively fertile spot for many of the artists Jack was inspired by, like Howlin' Wolf, B.B. King, and others. Recording began in February. Jack was the lead producer. Stuart Sykes, who would work with Jack again with Loretta Lynn's Jack-produced 2004 comeback album Van Leer Rose, was the lead engineer. Throughout the process, Jack regularly reminded Sykes that he wanted the record to sound good, but not too good. He wanted to keep in touch with the raw, living room-based sounds on the self-titled debut and Day Still, just with a tad more polish. Famously, the making of White Blood Cells was extremely rushed. The tracks were barely planned, with Jack and Meg sorting them out in an unfathomably quick fashion. Meg wasn't entirely comfortable with this. Even before arriving in Memphis, she had reservations about recording when they didn't have much settled. There was a method to Jack's madness, it seemed. Unfettered by Meg's worries, he despotically and very deliberately hastened production. The LP was recorded in one room in a mere 4 days. He wanted the unease to be evident on the album, as well as capture his and Meg's energy as honestly as possible. Said White, quote, "We just let the songs come out the way they come out, one at a time. It'll make a lot more sense than if it has all this premeditation behind it," unquote. Not everything on White Blood Cells was completely unplanned, though. The seventh track, The Union Forever, which is inspired by the 1941 movie Citizen Kane, was first thought up by Jack in 1993, right around the time he graduated from high school. Here's a clip of the final version. The cost no man can say, but you gotta love me. The bassist Dominic Sucha, better known as Dominic John Davis, has said that he remembers playing parts of the songs found on White Blood Cells in the years previously. The aforementioned The Union Forever, obviously, was around. Some Stripes shows as early as 1999 contain early cuts too. Now Mary was around when Jack was still playing with Two Star Tabernacle. Here is the draft that eventually made it on the album. Now Mary. The album's 11th song, I Think I Smell a Rat, has become one of Jack's favorite songs on the LP. It was written the day before he and Meg left for Memphis. Jack was home alone and was playing the piano to pass the time. He kept playing the same chord over and over, and the lyric, I Think I Smell a Rat, kept playing recurrently in his head. He couldn't think of anything else to go with it. During production, they were working on a different song called That's Where It's At that was almost used for their first album. Suddenly, the "I think I smell a rat" line came to Jax's mind again and merged with what they were already doing with "That's Where It's At." Here's an excerpt.
Oh, I think I smell a rat. Oh, I think I smell a rat. Oh, you little kids seem to think you know just where.
One of the album's best songs, Hotel Yorba, is about an actual flophouse in Jack's old neighborhood. Not long after the album came out, Jack and Meg tried to record a music video inside, but were turned down. Jack thought this was because they looked too respectable, prompting concerns from the Yorba's management that they were from the IRS or some other organization. Jack fondly remembers that, as he and Meg sat in their van outside in disbelief, they listened to an NPR review of the album, which at one point was interrupted by a clip from Hotel Yorba, which was deemed a highlight. Here's part of the song.
It might sound silly for me to think childish thoughts like these, but I'm so tired of acting tough and I'm gonna do what I please. Let's get married in a big cathedral by a priest, 'cause if I'm the man that you love.
White Blood Cells was ultimately completed in just 6 days. Today, it is one of the fastest recording processes for the Stripes. The album artwork, which came about soon after, is kind of telepathic. On the cover, Jack and Meg, of course dressed in and surrounded by black, white, and red, sit calmly as a group of shadowy photographers, who almost look like paparazzi, hone in. Jack has said that this was an allusion to the increasing attention the band was receiving from the music press at the time. The title, White Blood Cells, reflected how the bacteria that is the media was closing in. The album was released on July 3rd, 2001, a time that, like everything when it came to White Blood Cells, necessitated a bit of rushing. Earlier that year, Rolling Stone had included the Stripes on one of their bands to watch listicles. White Blood Cells, which was universally acclaimed almost immediately after hitting the shelves, saw a metamorphosis from formidable up-and-comers to actually successful rockers. The Stripes were essentially transplanted from being the best band in Detroit to being one of the best bands of the decade in general. Jack has said that at the time, he was worried things were moving too fast. Weeks after the album's release, the Stripes traveled to the United Kingdom to perform on John Peel's radio program, which consistently was able to make or break a band's reputation. Peel had first heard the band in a Dutch record shop and was enthused to have them on his show. Today, the performance is considered one of the band's finest moments. My favorite part of the program is the band's cover of Sunhouse's Death Letter. It miraculously sounds as if they were playing a raucous live show, which is all the more impressive since so many acts tend to sound discernibly reserved when playing on the radio. Take a listen. Peel would invite them on his program again in November, but the Stripes certainly kept themselves busy in between. By August, they were on the front cover of the UK music magazine New Musical Express. Soon afterward, they played a show attended by the supermodel Kate Moss, who would later be featured in their music video for I Just Don't Know What to Do With Myself, a cover featured on their next LP, Elephant. UK tabloids loved the Stripes. Headlines painted them as rock and roll music's future. In early 2002, the critics voting in the Village Voices' Paz and Jot poll named White Blood Cells the fourth best album of 2001, one below Bjork's Vespertine and one above Radiohead's Amnesiac. Jack and Meg were uncomfortable with the attention they were receiving. Jack remembers telling NME that he didn't want to be on the cover of the publication out of fear of scrutiny, but the magazine went ahead and put them on the cover anyway. There were anxieties that this attention would make audiences get sick of the Stripes before they could even realize their full potential. When the band returned home, things were already shifting. They were receiving more radio airplay, none of the bands with whom they were brought up were getting nearly as much attention from the press. Jack and Meg didn't want to admit it, but they were gaining momentum whether they were prepared for it or not. Late in 2001, the Stripes agreed to a two-album record deal with the US label V2, which would allow them to have total creative control and secure ownership of both their master recordings and their eventual publishing. It was then arranged that White Blood Cells, which had already been selling pretty well, would be re-released on Valentine's Day 2002, with its track listing and packaging unchanged. With a new, more financially lucrative label to back them, and with so many notable critical endorsements supporting them, it only made sense. Not long after this decision was made, the fourth track on White Blood Cells, Fell in Love with a Girl, began receiving more and more radio play. It eventually became a staple on well-listened-to, influential stations like Chicago's Q101 and QROQ. The song's popularity jumped exponentially when the Stripes agreed to let Michel Gondry, a rising, experimentally inclined French filmmaker, direct a Lego animated short to accompany the song. The video was rotated constantly on MTV, which helped turn people onto the band further. Though just under 2 minutes, the track exemplarily reflects the way it felt as though the Stripes burst onto the scene. Here's an excerpt. Now, 2002 was loaded with public appearances that would advance the Stripes' notoriety. In June, they performed at the MTV Music Awards. In August, they collected 3 trophies at the MTV Video Music Awards. Fell in Love with a Girl received recognition for its special effects and editing, and garnered the Stripes the Breakthrough Award. That same month, they did double date shows with The Strokes, another band who had gotten the rock and roll savior honorific. In October, the Stripes opened for the Rolling Stones for a handful of shows. Then, they even performed on Saturday Night Live. Around then, they also performed on Saturday Night Live, with John McCain as the host. Not long after, Jack took on a role in the movie Cold Mountain, which co-starred Renee Zellweger and Nicole Kidman and would become one of the most popular films of 2003. For the Stripes, White Blood Cells was essentially what started it all. It was an album that allowed them to move from the status of the greatest band you've never heard of to one of the greatest bands you've ever heard. It was also the LP that introduced just what Jack was capable of. In the years following, predicting what would come next became increasingly difficult. Though an album would be released every few years, after White Blood Cells came Elephant, Get Behind Me Satan, and Icky Thump, Jack regularly took on compelling side projects. In 2005, he co-founded the Raconteurs, a rock group that would release 2 albums in the 2000s but allowed Brendan Benson to take the frontman duties. In 2009, Jack co-formed the goth rock group The Dead Weather in Nashville. Again, he let someone else take the foremost lead. Alison Mossart of The Kills sang while he played the drums. The most stunning of Jack's non-Stripes ventures was arguably his executive producing of Loretta Lynn's extraordinary comeback album, Family Rose, which would be released in 2004 to rave reviews. It is an unexpected move from the man who'd been dubbed a rock champion just a few years back. It is certainly one of Lynn's truest, most authentically country albums. The whole LP is fantastic, but I particularly love its title track, on which Jack musicalizes the beautiful story of how Lynn's parents first met. Here's a snippet.
One night in mid-July, underneath that old blue Kentucky sky, well, that poor boy won, that beat his heart. Then my daddy would look at my mommy and smile as he brushed the hair back from my eyes, and he'd say, your mama, she's the family rose. She was the belle of Johnson County, Ohio River, too big sin, a beauty to behold.
By 2009, the Stripes would basically be no more, a reality brought on by Meg's acute anxiety. Since, Jack has released three solo albums, 2012's Blunderbuss, 2014's Lazaretto, and 2018's Boarding House Reach, and 2015's Dodge and Burn, an LP with the Dead Weather. I didn't discover the White Stripes until I was in middle school, which was right around the time they called it quits, yet I feel nostalgic about them. Those teenage years were formative for me in terms of discovering what I liked musically, and it's safe to say that the Stripes were the first band that got me into rock music. I had loved, as most people did, hits like Seven Nation Army, Icky Thump, and My Doorbell growing up. But after seeing White play live for the first time, and after watching the documentaries Under Great White Northern Lights, which covered the Stripes' Alaskan tour of 2007, and the Jack Heavy rockumentary It Might Get Loud, I was hooked. Why exactly I love the Stripes so much is hard to put into words. Does it have to do with their simplicity, the catchiness of their songs, their novel presentation, the way I do genuinely think Jack is a genius despite the fact that his ego is sometimes bothersome, how they remain so true to their aesthetic? I figured that's how it goes for most people when talking about their favorite albums, artists, movies, TV shows, etc. If there is some sort of connection based in one's developmental years, describing one's love in a clear-cut, succinct way proves itself elusive. I won't bother you with a critical analysis, but I hope I've at least persuaded you to take the time to look into the Stripes' discography if you haven't already. The Stripes are so much more than the hits. White Blood Cells is just a starting off point. Thanks for listening to the fifth episode of The Definitives. This episode was narrated, researched, and edited by me, Blake Peterson. If you'd like to know more about me, I recommend heading over to my website, petersoninterviews.com, which focuses on cinema, or my Twitter, @BlakeWPeterson. If you want to follow along with the show, next week I will be discussing 1969's Willie and the Poor Boys, the iconic studio album by the country rock group Creedence Clearwater Revival.